And this is FM 90.1, KZFR Chico, listener-supported community radio for the Sacramento Valley, the foothills, and beyond. And that revolution starts right now. You are listening to The Real Issue on KZFR Radio. This is Sue Hildebrand, and The Real Issue is a locally produced weekly public affairs talk show. We're here every Wednesday night from 6 until 7 p.m. This edition of The Real Issue is made possible by the generous contributions of KZFR supporters and by Edible Shasta Butte, celebrating the abundance of the North State season by season since 2007. Edible Shasta Butte is a quarterly magazine sharing in the edible community's goal to connect consumers with family farmers, chefs, and food artisans of all kinds. Edible Shasta Butte is available from Butte County to the Oregon border, and they're online at edibleshastabutte.com. So I want to first thank you to everyone who contributed to the station during our spring pledge drive. We reached and exceeded our goal of $45,000. So I got to say, y'all put the community in community radio. You are the reason we do what we do every single week. We are here to provide local public affairs, to share community events, and to share our love for the music and for culture. And you came through for us, and you showed your support for what we do here at KZFR. So really, thank you. Thank you so much for showing your support. So over the last few weeks and months, several things have happened around the issue of homelessness right here in California and in Butte County and Chico. It's often hard to follow everything, and it's even more difficult to determine if any of these efforts are having any impact on the crisis. Last month, California Ballot Proposition 1 was passed by voters during the primary election. The major component of Prop 1 authorizes almost $6.5 billion in state general obligation bonds for mental health treatment facilities and supportive housing for homeless veterans and homeless people with behavioral health challenges. Just last week, a state audit was released that analyzed the effectiveness of the $28 billion spent over the last 5 years on 30 different state programs designed to address homelessness. The findings of that report were across all programs, the data was not collected consistently, and therefore the efficacy of the state's efforts are inconclusive. Earlier this week, the city of Chico announced another round of anti-camping enforcements, which serves to scatter people from their makeshift camps, often to simply camp in another public space. Another call from the community for a sanctioned campground followed, just as it always does. Coming soon, the United States Supreme Court will hear a challenge to the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals on the Grants Pass case, which is similar to the discussion that ultimately required the city of Chico to provide more housing before it could move unhoused people from public spaces. It was this requirement that resulted in the very popular Pallet Shelter, which is just located near Costco in South Chico. And finally, on Friday night, a panel discussion is scheduled on Chico State campus called Future of Affordable Housing. State Assembly Member Alex Lee will present a proposal during that presentation for, quote, social housing. Chico City Council Member Addison Winslow will also be on the panel, as well as my guest for the hour and my very favorite housing expert, Ed Mayer. Ed Mayer is the Executive Director of the Housing Authority of Butte County, and I invited him in to the studio on The Real Issue to put into context the current state of homelessness in California, whether or not he believes we are making any progress in addressing the crisis, and if he sees any innovative solutions that can be applied here in California and right here in Butte County. It is always a pleasure to talk with you, Ed Mayer, and thanks for being here in the studio with me.
Thanks, Sue. It's always a pleasure to be here, and KZFR, it's just the best, so thank you.
You got it. And I was, you know, as I was preparing for the show, I always like to sort of pull up the last time folks were on the program, and I counted up, you actually haven't been on this program since 2021, which kind of blew my mind, and you have been on this program 6 times. So, and I told you this the other day when I talked with you, every time you're on this program, I always get floods of people emailing me and texting me and saying, God, that was great. So thanks for being here and shedding more light on this crisis that we can't seem to address. So Ed Mayer, I want to start first of all by, you know, when I, this was not a question I had planned on asking, but, you know, when I said, quick, give me some songs about home, you said, let's just talk about home. And so I do want to start this conversation. I want to set the context of this conversation for the entire hour. Why do you do this work? And I think it comes down to your understanding what the value of home is.
Very good. Well, at the heart of all of this, for all of us, we wouldn't do very well as individuals or communally without home. And this idea of home goes way, way back culturally. In fact, the word home is one of the oldest words in the English language. It's Germanic, and it it speaks to this archetype. This, on the one hand, you have shelter from the elements, which, in addition to food and community and clothing, are really the four essentials of human existence. This idea of shelter is also profound because at our feet in our shelter, we're connected to the earth, and we have overhead generally a roof, which is peaked. It connects us to the heavens. So there's this spiritual peace to dwelling, the connection between heaven and earth embodied in the idea of home. And then inside the home, you have the hearth. At least in ancient homes, hearths are conspicuously missing from today's homes. But it's like the heart of the being, the heart of the family. And if you think about a home and home life, what does it mean to all of us? Our domestic families, our core families, grow up in the same dwelling. Our dwelling is very patterned in our homes. And so here we are as a species living on this planet. What are we doing? We're dwelling. Well, how do we dwell? A great part of what we do is spend time in our domestic home, in our dwelling. It's so central to our beingness. So you take that centrality to our existence, and a home exists not in a vacuum. A home exists in a neighborhood, and you have neighbors. And this idea of neighborhood extends then to community, extends to then identity, whether it's a state or nation, and a global community. And so the only way we connect to each other, is to recognize sort of these fundamental building blocks, and that fundamental building block is the home itself. So central to that idea, this has powered my entire career over 50 years now in architecture and in planning and real estate development, and finally 30 years in affordable housing. This idea that not everyone on the planet gets to have a home. That's a profound idea. And what we consider home as a society varies from society to society. And so how we allow people to provide themselves for themselves or not in the context of home and dwelling and providing shelter for themselves, it varies widely across the planet. So the game here, of course, as we hone in on homelessness in America and in California and here in Chico, is this idea that we live in a society, Plato put it best back when he wrote The Republic. How do you best design a society so that it provides, he put it in terms of justice, but give everybody a leg up, give everybody a chance. How do you design a society to do that? And we have a society right now which, if you look at it, has really satisfied the needs, the wants, the desires of those who own and dwell in single-family homes. For those who dwell in multifamily dwellings and who don't have homes, it's a whole nother story. And those populations are dominated by the elderly and the disabled, those, let's just say, less fortunate, those challenged by life circumstances, health issues, other issues, employment issues. So this idea of lack of housing and lack of that foundational element in the richest society on the planet is a very interesting contradiction. Now, homelessness in California in particular, but in America, is worse than it has been. It's going to get worse because of the demographics of our situation right now. We have the baby boomer generation that's aging out. The baby boomer generation demographically is the largest single cohort of America's population. And as it ages out, some of us have done okay and some of us baby boomers have not done very well. 50% of the baby boomers who are leaving the workforce are leaving the workforce with Social Security income or less. Well, standard Social Security income might be around $950 a month right now. Can you imagine a California senior relying on $950 a month? We're seeing more and more numbers of seniors coming into our front doors at the Housing Authority, desperate for housing. They're living in their automobiles. They're struggling, and it's only going to get worse. That is combined with the fact that in terms of providing for housing opportunity, we have a decade's worth of chronic lack of housing for single and small-sized households. We have a real lack of one in studio bedroom housing right now. That housing is really needed for our elderly, really needed for this low-income population, and is really needed for actually households in formation. The younger households, grandchildren of the baby boomers, are now in household formation. They're looking for one-bedroom apartments just to start a life. So there's this tremendous competition and underproduction. The underproduction we can talk about, but it's really a function of our system that we've set up. It's systemic, and it's a function of the laws and regulations and policies that we live by as a community. We have made these choices that have resulted in the homelessness around us, we as a community.
Ed Mayer, I'm happy that you paused there for a second, because you were dangerously close moving into how'd we get here. And I really do want to pause and just sort of acknowledge that your explanation of what a home is and what it does. And I do want to pause it, because I do want to just sort of underscore the idea of Plato and the Republic and all of those things that what a home really means. So just some quick notes that I took is, you know, we used to talk about homeless people as if those people are defined by the fact that they don't have a home. And so then we started to move into that label or descriptor of an unsheltered person. And then I've done many programs right here on KCFR where we've talked about the state of homelessness is sort of the manifestation of the failures of society and all of those things. But then as you bring up this idea that, you know, Plato and the need for housing in terms of justice, another angle that made me think of it is, you know, in a society like ours where individual freedom is sort of fundamental to how most of us view the world, if we think about it, if somebody doesn't have a home to get good sleep, to clean themselves, to stay healthy, to cook and to eat and to have community, then you can't actually have individual freedom, because your every waking moment is based on pure survival. And so we don't have the ability to be free in this society that is based on the concept of individual freedom.
Well, if you look at human existence as a game of trying to overcome our obstacles and attain our fullest potential, then seeing citizens in the cycles of homelessness is really an unfortunate waste of human potential.
Yep.
It's really sad. But, you know, there's a larger malaise at foot that you put your finger on, and I keep going back to these systemic issues. It's much more than homelessness. I mean, from my perspective in the housing business, our homeless fellow citizens are simply those who have been displaced in a vicious game of musical chairs, where there just aren't enough musical chairs are there, and those with the least resource and the least recourse have no place to go. And so that's who we see on the streets for the most part. The other side of this, though, is this is just the tip of the iceberg. The Harvard University has an institute on housing, and every year they do a study and a report on housing in America. This year's report was seminal. And I say seminal because there was sort of this threshold reached. 50% of households renting apartments in America are paying more than 30% of their household income on rent and utilities, which is considered rent burdened. Half of those are paying more than 50% of their income for rent and utilities. This is what destabilizes society, when households are paying so much of their household income for rent and utilities that they don't have resources for the rest of their life, whether it's insurance or, you know, the schooling, their supplies, clothing, food for their family, whatever. So the other side of all of this, and I always try to remember this somewhere in the conversation, is economic opportunity. You know, housing is affordable in the sense that it costs X amount. If wages were better, housing would be more easily affordable. But we've had fairly static wages. We've had absolutely static wages since 1980, basically. That has been aggravated by increased costs, record corporate profits, et cetera, et cetera. I digress. But the issue here with housing is we've got this system where there's a huge number of American households. More than half of the households who rent in America are challenged with their housing. their housing costs.
Mm.
That's alarming.
Mm-hmm.
And so you see you witness the homelessness, you see households in economic distress, you see what that does to family systems, latchkey children growing up without intact family systems, the stress on families, the divorce rate, the transience of jobs in society. It can be a little scary. On the other hand, America has been built on transience. We're very resilient. Human beings are incredibly resilient. So the real issue is, where do we go from here?
Yeah. Yeah. If you're just tuning in, you're listening to The Real Issue on KZFR Radio. I have Ed Mayer, who is the executive director of the Housing Authority of the County of Butte, which I always think it's a funny title as opposed to saying Butte County Housing Authority. So I always try to say it correctly. It's the Housing Authority of the County of Butte. Ed Mayer, you started to kind of answer a lot of my questions. I have a whole list of questions, and you started to answer my questions in different ways. But I just want to tease out the answers. You mentioned that we're just seeing, you said a few different times, you said we're just seeing the tip of the iceberg. Our homeless crisis is going to get even worse because of baby boomers that are getting ready to they're retired or they're getting ready to retire on pretty low incomes, and they are competing for for basic housing. So you started to tease that, but break it down for us. It's going to get worse, but break it down. I'm curious to know. We see it here in California. Most of the lack of affordable housing is in California. We're seeing the largest number, largest percentage of people that are unhoused in California. We have lots and lots of folks right here in Chico, and many of our elected officials say, just move them along, make them go someplace else. They're not our responsibility. Break it down for us, nationwide, statewide, countywide, and right here in Butte, if you can do that for us.
I'll try to give you some perspective.
Yeah.
Okay, so first of all, statewide, Chico's or Butte County is unique, and it's a very illustrative regarding the whole issue of homelessness and the lack of housing opportunity, which is really what we're struggling with. In other words, if someone wants to find a home to live in, rent or buy or otherwise, where do you find one? We have a lack of supply, generally, across all the markets of America, in particular in California, and in particular in California for certain reasons, which are systemic and regulatory in particular. And then this Butte County was, I'll just say, blown out by the campfire disaster.
Yep.
And
yep.
So that made all of the dynamics that you see at play in the nation, which are intensified in California, make them grossly intensified, hyper-intensified in Butte County, where we had, at least for a short period of time, a couple of years, hyper-homelessness in the area. Chico saw an instant population gain of 15,000 people, more than 15% of the population. And where did they go? They didn't go anywhere. They've been absorbed.
Right.
They've been absorbed. And I think absorbed in many ways, you can't blame local people. There's some resentment at having to absorb Paradise's problem. I mean, this is sort of interesting to look at the landscape of jurisdictions and how different. This is where you get into the identity of your community. Well, why should my community pay for their community? That was their problem. You know, they get all the federal money. I mean, gee. And so, is there brotherhood or is there not? Do you welcome these? Do you welcome these? And I'll call them refugee populations. I think it might have been the last time I was on this show. I made reference to these refugee populations coming out of Paradise, and I got a call the next day from a military officer who said he worked overseas and took offense to the term because a refugee is someone who doesn't have a country. And I said, well, my experience is, for all practical purposes, these people do not have a country. There's no one who's going to bat for them, providing them housing or relief services. They're disenfranchised citizens at this point.
Right.
So in my mind, they kind of are like refugees, but let's, for the discussion's sake, just call them displaced.
What was his reaction to that?
I think we agreed to disagree.
Okay. All right. Go
Fair
on.
Enough. And, you know, I took it in the spirit of not lighthearted, but earnest interaction with good ideas and trying to refine our terms and be specific about what we're talking about. But, you know, these are displaced populations, regardless, and they're still displaced. And the lack of rubber band in our system, the lack of capacity to pick up displaced populations, the lack, we had triage, but what we didn't have was transitional and long-term housing strategies.
Right.
And we still don't to this day, woefully inadequate. So, you know, on the other hand, there were some wins in the disaster relative to what we've done with affordable housing. But homelessness and this idea that there's huge segments of the population who are in trouble. Mm. And Butte County is no exception. I mean, the poverty rate in Butte County is very high. I always go back to these statistics. I hate to tell them, but they just illustrate the severity of the issue. 60% of renter households in Oroville pay more than 50% of their income for rent and utilities.
Yep.
And it's 40% in Chico. That's huge. And so there's not a lot of economic opportunity. If you're thinking about looking for a job, you're going to get a 32-hour-a-week job with no benefits, that kind of thing. You're going to cobble together this and that to make wheels turn. But, you know, it's a difficult economic environment, and that applies statewide. Now, another way to look at this statewide, I was very curious to see if there were high concentrations of homelessness in certain communities and not others. So I did this while I was sitting at a conference during a session that wasn't very interesting. And I on the back of a napkin, with my iPad, I started looking at cities. What's the population of this city? What's the population of that city? I lined up about 10 cities, Los Angeles, San Francisco, Sacramento, Chico, Redding. And then I put down the number of homeless households that were found in the most recent HUD home PIT survey. The number came out the same. Doesn't matter where it was. 1%.
Really?
1%. 1% of your local population is unsheltered, and they're local. They come from the locals. They are local. They're elderly. They're disabled. Sure, there's youth. There's drug abusers. I mean, if you're a fentanyl addict, you cannot come in because there's no place to come down without dying. So you stay out on the streets. I mean, there's a lot of subpopulations and subdynamics. But the point is this population on the streets are those with the least recourse, least resource, least abled, most challenged. And that's doesn't speak well to, we get back to the bigger picture of, you know, are we civilized?
Exactly.
Do we take care of our elderly and our disabled first? Instead of calling the police, do we have a social service agency that shows up in a van with a couple of folks, a couple of caseworkers who say, hey, what's your situation? Hey, let's fix it up.
Yeah.
Let's take you to some place where you can get some help instead of taking you to jail or rousting you. I mean, I have great sympathy for the police here and great respect for what they do. Society has tasked them with something that is really probably not in their wheelhouse.
Right, right.
They're not trained or, you know, this shouldn't be a police matter. This is a social matter.
Yep.
And we're not willing to pay the price for the decisions we've made to, how should I say, maintain the kind of community we think we deserve. That's a terrible thing to say, but we're spoiled. We're spoiled brats.
Yep. If you're just tuning in, you're listening to The Real Issue on KZFR Radio. We're talking about a lot of stuff, but the main focus is the idea of homelessness, and we're not talking about one particular thing, but I do have Ed Mayer here, the executive director of the Housing Authority of the County of Butte, because he's so good at this and he's so interesting. And one of the things that is so good about Ed, that you're so good at this is that you're so compassionate. You understand it intellectually, but you come at it, as far as I can tell, from a sense of compassion and community, and what does it all mean, and why are we doing what we do, and as a human species, you know, what is the purpose of all of this? And it's such a wonderful approach. This, the last thing that you just said, I think is a good way for us to step into that next step of what are the solutions. You mentioned that you did kind of a back of the envelope, or if you were in a bar, it'd be on the cocktail napkin or whatever, found that in many cities across California, it was 1% of the population were homeless or unhoused or unsheltered.
Unsheltered. There's a lot more homeless that are sheltered in emergency shelter,
okay,
and more homeless that are sheltered in transitional housing. There's a whole, how should I say, continuum of relative homelessness. As some would call it, the homeless industrial complex. But we have many ways of, how should I say, keeping the homeless in sort of a off-the-street state where they don't necessarily have permanent housing. a lot of our money and funding goes to these sort of triage temporary situations.
And so as I was listening to you kind of explain your findings, it sounded to me like that is our level of tolerance. Like, for example, I'm okay if I see these homeless encampments once a week, but when I have to see it every day, then something has to get done about it. That it's, I'm just using that as an example, but it seems like if you find that 1% across the state in most communities or the communities that you quickly tested, it's 1%. It seems like in this society, we have a level of tolerance of, yeah, I'm willing to tolerate seeing people living on the street in that particular situation. I'm okay with that. It seems cultural, almost.
Well, you know, open heart, closed heart. How do you encounter the beggar on the street? Do you give them a smile? Do you give them something? Do you walk by? It's always a choice.
Yeah.
And, you know, ultimately, it's a karmic choice, I guess. But the idea is to try to be kind to each other, remembering that we're all citizens and that we all have a role in society. Even that beggar, even that person who just repulses us, there's a role here, and part of it might be to elicit the compassion, to think well on how it is we're living in our community. So, you know, I go to this, I struggle with this because I have a beautiful home. I live in a beautiful part of the county. I'm very blessed. I'm grateful. But I look at the people who don't have that, and it bothers me that how can I set things up so that those who don't have can have a home? It's very, very difficult. So in our community, you look at what kind of community do we live in? And this community here in Chico is very similar in my mind to what I consider, I call other ecotopian communities, places like Bend, Oregon, Missoula, Montana, Santa Cruz, San Luis Obispo. I mean, really cool communities, great communities of well-thinking, well-intentioned people who are very sensitized to the environment, and they move there for the beauty and the hometown values of that community. And after 30 years, all of a sudden, the community has doubled in size, and they've got this resentment. And it's like, no more growth. Stop. I just want it to stop. And you get this attitude going where, I mean, Chico's a very good illustration. There's not an affordable housing project that goes off in this town that doesn't meet with, excited neighborhood response. And I understand. I get it. People don't want to move to a multi-story apartment urban fabric. They want single-family home fabric because of what it means to them in terms of this dwelling. But we have to mature. And, you know, something in our California attitude, maybe maturity is the wrong word, in welcoming the broader spectrum of our society fully, we have to embrace the kind of housing that's going to house them. Now, I mean, we stopped building housing for the elderly and disabled. The federal government did back in the 1990s. We stopped building public housing in the 1990s. So it's no wonder that these populations began to emerge. The state hasn't had really a coherent program building for these populations. You have to remember these low-income populations, they require subsidy. And so collectively, whether it's us collectively putting in for roads or collectively putting in for sewers or water infrastructure, we have to collectively invest in public housing. In large part because we've fallen so far behind the eight ball, it's too expensive, it's prohibitively expensive to think that the private sector is going to be able to come in, deliver a product that will be affordable to someone on a Social Security income. The financial metrics just don't make any sense. So you need deeply subsidized projects in order to be able to have these properties affordable to people on limited incomes, and then that's where these other kinds of financing come in. So, you know, it's interesting. If you look at the history of socioeconomic struggle in America, you get past the 1800s and the farmer worker struggle in the Northeast. You get into the age of the robber barons, the industrialists, who collected enormous amounts of wealth. And by the time you got to the 1920s, there was this enormous discrepancy in wealth between the rich and the poor. We witnessed this today. There were no real safeguards in the workforce. There was no such thing as affordable housing or government social programs, and basically the economy collapsed. And it had to be rebuilt. And there was a new contract with society. It's called the New Deal. And there was a new structure. And Social Security went into place. The Federal Housing Administration went into motion. So housing authorities, for example, as entities which built public housing, publicly subsidized housings, were creatures of the New Deal. All kinds of things happened there. We had a similar meltdown in the 1960s. I think almost 60 American cities were burnt to the ground because of the disenfranchised populations, mostly minority populations, and that precipitated the Civil Rights Act, Fair Housing Act, and a bunch of other things that brought us Section 8 and the welfare society. And then finally we get to today, and I have to be honest, my associates and I in the business, deeply in the business, we've been looking at the trajectory of this country for 30 years wondering, when is it going to collapse? When is it going to collapse? When are too many Americans going to be sitting there in bread lines with no economic opportunity? And, talk about no economic. If I had no economic opportunity in today's day and age, I would be angry. And how would I express that disenfranchisement? People like Donald Trump, who want to burn the house down, start looking pretty good because they're not the corporations who have not delivered on the wage promise, and they're not the government who's failed us on the social side. So, burn the place down. Let's start all over again.
Right.
That's a little dangerous. So I go back to this idea of housing. If everyone had affordable housing, you wouldn't have this disenfranchisement. You wouldn't have this malaise. You wouldn't have this anger. You wouldn't have this divisiveness. We could be a peaceable society and get about our business and grow up and be fantastic human beings.
Ed Mayer, as I listen, of course I can't help but think of this is exactly what Karl Marx predicted would happen. And we did see it in the 1920s and in the early 30s. And with the New Deal, many people will say, Marx was correct. That's exactly what happened. And now we're seeing the rollback of it, and we've seen the rollback of it over the last 100 years. But it's interesting, as you said, for 30 years I've been saying, when is this all going to collapse around us? Let me ask you, I have a question that I want to bring in about infill versus developments like Valley's Edge. But before we get there, you've said a lot, but I want to just ask the question straight on, directly. What is the cause of homelessness in this country,
A selfish society.
Go on.
Simply, it's a sort of the same thing I hear often with elderly. I don't want to pay school taxes anymore. My children, I paid my taxes. My children have gone to school. They're now productive members of society. I shouldn't have to pay.
Mm-hmm.
We have this attitude that we can pick and choose what we want to support. I approach life a little more broadly. We're all in this together. We all play team ball. We all got to play ball. We all have to contribute every time in every way in a balanced way. But we have to, and we can't exclude ourselves. And one of the things that did create huge structural problems for the state budget and local revenues, but Prop 13 really tilted the table.
Yeah.
Really tilted the table.
Which was freezing the property tax from...
The irony of Prop 13 and the federal mortgage tax deduction is if you add all of those benefits up, they far dwarf any benefits we provide to low-income people by way of housing benefits.
Yep.
I mean, we get outraged by, oh my God, look at all the money we're putting in public housing, or oh my gosh, look at all the money we're spending in tax credits. But you look at it compared to mortgage interest deduction and these, and Prop 13, it's peanuts.
Right. So Ed Mayer, the now that we know that from the expert view of why of housing in general and the importance of housing in a civil society and the meaning of life, and I just love that. You're in a lot of different ways we can talk about the problem is because of selfishness. One of the things that you said earlier is we have a history, I think, dating back to the 1950s, where we have had these developments. My family actually lived in Levittown, New York, one of the very first planned communities where you had the white picket fence and you had the, you know, the transportation system for cars, not for walking in necessarily. Anyway, we just saw the defeat of Valley's Edge, which was a big development. I think it probably will come around again sooner rather than later. I doubt they just let it go. But the alternative, the opponents of Valley's Edge said, this is not going to solve or even help with our lack of affordable housing. And the answer is infill. I want to ask you, how realistic, if we look at Chico, and I don't mean let's look at it by the numbers, but in terms of a real solution to the lack of affordable housing, is infill the right idea?
Infill is a right idea.
Okay.
One of many strategies. So optimally in a community, you use a variety of strategies. One of them will be infill. One of them will be infill and high density along transit corridors. Another will be, so what you're trying to do, here's the game, is that our community is growing. Now, do we want it to grow? I don't know. I maybe yes, maybe no. But what I know of Chico's growth is that if you look back, it's grown very slowly, about 1% to 1.5% per year. Very slowly. It's a background growth. It's not like huge amounts of people are moving here. There's been no waves, nothing. It's been very consistent. So looking at history, there's no reason to think it won't continue the same going forward. Well, that means we're going to double again in 30 to 50 years in size. We'll be 200,000. Imagine Chico with 200,000 people. Where are they going to go?
Right.
So in answer to that, we've already bound ourselves. We've got geographic boundary to the east. We've got the green line to the west. We can go north-south, but incrementally. But the issue is really where do you want to go? And how many strategies do you want to deploy? And from the developer side, from the supply side, what you want to see is a predictable path to development. What you don't want to do is enter into a community where the path to development fruition is unpredictable,
yep.
Where it's subject to things like voter referendums, where anybody can, you know, where things are arbitrary and capricious, where there might be unreasonable asks of the community, you know, build that bridge over there and as a condition for building your property over here. Again, this goes back to this idea that we should all share in the cost of growth because it's in our communal best interest, and actually we'll get the best outcome if we embrace it in that way. If we shove off this idea that this is our responsibility and put it on the back of the developer is motivated to do as little as possible in terms of community benefit because it's so expensive. But the larger idea here is that the community needs to develop in a predictable way. So in Chico, Valley's Edge was one of a number of special planning areas.
Mm-hmm.
And there's not a lot of inventory in the Chico area for land development. My understanding was that if you included Valley's Edge, there were only 3 subdivision areas left designated for development before you had to go start thinking about Plan B or C. It's a community's choice. Build here or build there. I think the only interesting part of the Valley's Edge discussion was a piece of ground that had been fought over once before in the community.
Yeah. Yep.
Back in general plan days. And then all of a sudden, I guess we have a new day and age, the public can change its mind. So I go back to Plato. We in California have a blessing, and that is that we have a constitution that is very populist. The public in California is very strong. In any jurisdiction, we can gather up signatures for a referendum, and we can challenge a decision of our local government we don't like. That's very powerful. But it also leads to decisions that may not be in the best interest of the community. So the Valley's Edge subdivision was controversial simply because it really represented that predictable path to growth. It had already been baked into the cake of the general plan. It had been fought over once. Here it comes forward for fruition, and the community changed its mind. That's difficult. Chico will have to reconcile with that in the future in terms of its ability to invite people to take the risk to do sizable amounts of housing. The more restricted Chico can make its market, this is the sad truth of the matter, the more the benefit to the single-family homeowner. The less housing there is, the higher the price of the housing. So this idea of restriction of housing supply constantly, whether it's in gross terms or subtle terms, feathers the nest of the single-family homeowner because their property prices keep appreciating.
We'll bring that back. This is not where I had another question for you, but let's talk. Your last comment kind of threw me a little bit. I mean, I get it. When we have more restrictive regulations around building and creating affordable housing, then the single family housing is more expensive. However, the Valley's Edge development was all larger single family development, and so that's kind of what I'm missing here is that it, based on your description early on, where you know we need to start, we need to move away from that single family housing model because it doesn't really serve this growth. So it seems like you just sort of threw me there because I was with you, and then I was like, wait a minute, that isn't consistent with what I thought you were going to say.
Well, I don't think the single family home model is going to go away, and there's still demand in the market. And we do know enough about the Chico real estate market that there's basically a shortage of housing across all income cohorts, even for sale housing at the upper end, the upper middle end, I mean, et cetera. There's not a housing cohort in Chico that's not impacted. We also know that you build one unit anywhere in the spectrum of affordability, from affordable to an upper-end house out in the country, it affects the entire market. So supply is a function, really, ultimately, of just simple numbers.
Yeah.
How many units? And Valley's Edge, you know, for what it was, I don't remember, was it 3,000 or 4,000, maybe 5,000 units of housing represented over a 20-year period of time. It had a mixed bunch of housing. It's just one of many pieces, but it's not a piece that's going to come to fruition. So where else? That's the real issue. I was just having a discussion today with another nonprofit about where do we find a piece of ground in town to do business on. And we're looking in light industrial areas for housing. The land that is available and zoned properly is tightly held.
Yeah.
It's closely held.
Yeah. If you're just tuning in, you're listening to The Real Issue on KZFR Radio. I have the executive director of the Housing Authority of the County of Butte, Ed Mayer, here in the studio with me. Ed, you travel. Last time I tried to get you on the program, you weren't able to because you answered the phone when I called you. You were in Italy, which I was very jealous, I will say. But I know that you travel. I assume you have seen and you know about a lot of innovative solutions around the world. I want to ask you, talk about some of the things some of the ideas that you would like to see implemented here in this country. But of course, I really would like to hear what you think would work here in Butte County.
Oh, interesting you say that. Well, first of all, one noticeable difference between the rest of the world and America here is that in America, we do not allow any such thing as informal housing. We don't allow people to build sheds, shacks, shanty towns, nothing. Most of the world tomorrow, most of tomorrow's world is being built today as shanty towns around the large urban centers, Rio de Janeiro, Cairo, et cetera, et cetera. So you have these miles of shanty towns, hardly served by utilities. But you know what? ultimately they become urban fabric. It's really interesting how humans dwell. So there's this really organic nature to human dwelling. And right after the campfire disaster, I've told people, right next to Walmart was this enormous field. It was filled with people. I walked out in that place, and people were already organizing cul-de-sacs and community out there. And so around the world, these the barrios of the world are – that's where most of today's population lives, in urban areas. So we don't allow that in America.
Which, let me ask you this. You say that in sort of a romantic way. On the other hand, it's very dangerous. Well, there's not a lot of, and I'm not saying, you know, all or nothing, but it's like, yes, and I've seen, I was at Walmart right after the campfire, but also I've traveled all over the world and I've seen the barrios and I have seen, you know, I've been to India, I've been to a lot of different places where you sort of go, holy cow, and there is community and there is a, you know, there is an economic system and it's really this thriving community. On the other hand, if a fire breaks out, you could lose the entire community.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's so true. But, you know, the idea is left to your own devices. If you were on the streets by yourself and you saw a piece of cardboard, you'd pick it up and that would be the first part of your shelter.
That's right.
You would gather it up and you'd gather fuel and you'd gather supplies and you'd start making home. That's what we do. Now, what's interesting, in America, we've got this really high barrier to entry. Unless you can afford a three-bedroom, two-bath house with a double-car garage, you don't have any. There's no choice below that.
Right.
So it's interesting. Not even tiny houses do we make available. Not even tiny unplumbed houses. Not even shared housing. We got rid of all of our SROs, single-room occupancy dwellings that were a staple of this country from the 40s through the 60s. They're all gone now. And so we need to expand the way we think about human dwelling. I mean, fine, trailers, that's a small little house. You put them in trailers, put them in a tiny house. But do you let people do their own thing?
Yeah.
And do you, if you do, where? Because people are really resourceful. You don't need to give them much, and they'll put together a house in a hurry. Let me tell you, it may not be pretty. It might not be fire safe. So there's that piece. Now, this is not unprecedented. Back in the 1930s, the Dust Bowl refugees that came to California's Central Valley were as welcome here as the homeless generally in California today. And the federal government had to step in, and they built at first six refugee camps and then ultimately 32 refugee camps up and down the Central Valley to house this displaced population from Oklahoma and the Midwest from the Dust Bowl. And it took about 20, 30 years to integrate that population. You know, you talk displaced populations. We have this idea that we can reintegrate them or they should be integrated in society in 3 months or 6 months. It takes decades.
Right.
Especially because the ones that go longer and longer are the ones with the least resource and least recourse. Right. So here we are at the 5 years after the campfire disaster, and the households we're working with on the street from the campfire disaster are those who just had the least to work with.
Yeah. And you know, it's interesting. What hit me is that you said right after, you know, during the Dust Bowl in the 30s and so many folks came to California creating these camps, and then the government finally came in and said, okay, let's sort of deal with this. Oh, go ahead.
So an idea. So the government came in and intervened.
Yeah.
Okay, lesson learned. And we forgot our lessons. So first of all, structured campgrounds are a solution that we are not properly using today. We have social service agencies who can run them. They're tried and true. They're proven. Usually they're in size. They're usually around 60 units, 60 persons per campground. So that's something that can certainly be done. But what do you do about the bigger picture? What have we done? And so our response to the campfire here in Butte County has been illustrative, kind of cool. Whether anybody knows it or not, we have, I think, the largest investment in affordable housing in the history of America going off in Butte County right now.
What?
$1.3 billion of investment in 3,100 units of affordable housing in Butte County on a per capita basis. And Butte County is only 220,000 people. On a per capita basis, it's the largest investment in socialized housing in the history of America.
Huh.
So the question is, with the completion of all this housing we see going up around us right now, all this tax credit subsidized housing that's a function of disaster recovery, will it move the needle,
yeah.
the socioeconomic needle?
Yeah.
Will it make those rent burdens a little more easy to bear for those households, rent burden in Oroville and Chico? Will it make their, will they be able to get housing in those units and may actually be able to get a breath?
Yeah. Yeah.
So we got an experiment. Another 2 or 3 years, we'll be at the end of that experiment. It points to, if it does move the needle, it points to massive investment in local housing infrastructure as a solution to our problems.
Mm-hmm.
So that's one direction.
Mm-hmm.
Kind of cool.
And I only rolled my eyes because I can hear people pushing back and saying, I do not want to pay more taxes for other people to have a house. I worked hard.
Well, would you rather have them homeless?
Yeah, exactly.
You know, it really is. It's just choices.
Yeah, that's right.
And the interesting thing about investing in housing is you're not just, it's not just a welfare check, which just goes and gets spent. You build an asset. It's a public asset. And there's revenues. There's rental revenue. It actually, there's money involved. It's an asset. So you're actually investing in something like a sewer line or a water line or a utility that it yields returns and also social returns.
Ed Mayer, here I have a whole other page of questions for you. So I can't, you know, I'm looking at the time. You know, what's interesting is I go back to your comment where I said, what is the cause of homelessness? And you know, there's a lot of different ways, a lot of things. There's regulation, there's population, there's public policy, there's all of these different things that have contributed. But you said essentially it's this selfish culture.
Gross self-interest. We're wired that way. We humans, we feather our own nest first,
yep,
right? We want our cup of coffee before we go do something today.
Yes.
And if I don't have my cup, man, I'm freaking out.
Well, that coffee is survival. At this point. But what's interesting is what hit me is you were talking about the camps after the in response to the Dust Bowl, and then the government came in and said, hey, let's do something here. I'm wondering, and I only have a minute or so left, I'm wondering is, do you suspect that it is, and I know you're so good at not getting in trouble politically, but I wonder if maybe the local government does not want to sanction a campground, because once you sanction a campground, then the local government has to take responsibility for what's going on there.
Well, you said it. I mean, it's a double-edged sword, and really, it's a community choice. I think if you look at it politically, our representatives are very good at representing their constituency. So I look to the constituency, not the representatives. And the constituency says, no, we don't want to deal with this issue. It's an ugly urban issue.
Right.
We like our beautiful eco-topia.
Yep. Ed Mayer, on Friday, you're going to be on a panel discussion, and the name of that panel discussion, I just lost it in my notes. It's called The Future of Affordable Housing. It's going to take place on Chico State Campus. It's from 6 to 8 p.m. in the Arts Building, Arts 112. Assembly member Alex Lee, very young. I just learned that he actually lives with his parents. He doesn't even have a home. He rents or stays for free with his parents. Very young assembly member. Chico City Council member Addison Winslow will also be there. And you are going to be on the panel. Talk about, in 30 seconds, what is your contribution? And,
Tomorrow's panel is actually, I'm excited. It's very rare in a public forum that we get to talk about the big, big, big picture. If we could do anything, what would it be?
Yeah.
And Assemblyman Lee has come forward with an idea for socialized housing that's very broad. And so we're going to stick to some big examples, big ideas, and it should be a fun conversation.
I think it's going to be a lot of fun. So that's Friday night, 6 to 8 p.m. on Chico State Campus, Arts 112. I don't bring you on this program often enough, Ed Mayer, so promise you'll come back sooner rather than later.
Absolutely. We've got that second page of questions, so anytime.
That's right. I do, and I will say for anybody that has questions for Ed Mayer, send them to me at sue@kzfr.org, and I'll build a giant list for you, and I'll bring you back sooner.
Always a pleasure, Sue, very much.
Thank you so much. All right, this brings us to the end of this edition of The Real Issue, which was made possible by the generous contributions of KCFR supporters and by Robert Amendola and Associates, a law corporation providing legal representation for accident victims. Robert Amendola and Associates can be contacted at 916 916- 924-8787. Hmong translation is available by calling 916-599-0039 and just ask for Mr. Yang. Thanks once again for listening to The Real Issue and for supporting KZFR Radio. Until next time, peace out.
I'll light the fire. You place the flowers in the vase that you bought today. Staring at the fire for hours and hours while I listen to you.